In the news.
Howdy, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American Government.
And we're experimenting with the brand new split screen format. Professor McDaniel is in an undisclosed location for his own protection, not yours. So bear with us as we Skype in for half of this session. We're actually going to flip roles next week. I'm going to be in an undisclosed location, high in the mountains. I have many enemies. But this week, I'm here in the studio in Austin. Professor McDaniel's away, but we're going to handle the second in the news segment. A couple things I wanted to mention before we get to topics in the news this week. The first is, as you know, you're following along in your syllabus and following the schedule assiduously, of course. We have an exam next week, not this week, but next. I believe it's Thursday. Please pay attention to the syllabus for details with respect to the timing and the logistics and all the important details associated with that examination, okay? If you have questions beyond the syllabus, please feel free to contact us. Otherwise, you know, I'm okay sometimes with an occasional email asking me about information that's clearly in the syllabus, but I really would kind of prefer it if you check the syllabus before you, you know, ping me with an email. I think that's a matter of convenience that sometimes a little overused by students. It's not just students, I do it too sometimes. I'll ping my chair about something I could easily look up, but you know, make sure you check with the syllabus because frankly, the syllabus is kind of the Bible. It's the, you know, the authority of record for the class. And so it's in your interest to make sure you're adhering to what's in the syllabus. Another point I want to make real briefly before we get to the In the News segment this week is I've had a couple of students who asked me about the In the News segments and assignments. I tell you what, a couple of students wrote interesting responses to the first in the news question, emphasizing kind of their personal views on, in the case of the first news in the news segment, it was a couple of items on abortion. You know, they sort of wrote about their opinion on abortion. Now look, we love you, we appreciate and respect your opinion, but you're better off responding to course materials and trying to integrate course concepts and theories as opposed to telling us what your opinion is on the topic. So when we talk about immigration or Democratic nomination politics or you know, affirmative action or whatever Professor McDaniel and I happen to be talking about, your task in the news assignments is to relate the specific events that are unfolding today in real time with broader concepts that we're introducing in lecture and in the readings. Right? That's the point of those. You don't need much. You know, a couple students asked me, is there a you know, a suggested word count? Well, the quick version is no, there's not. You know, but you ought to be able to do a, you know, decent paragraph or a half page. That's certainly adequate to demonstrate that you're connecting the dots, that you're taking the materials that you're reading and hearing about and applying them to what's going on in the news. And that's what we want, right? When you guys go, you know, back for summer vacation, talk to your parents and they ask you about something, you know, if you're a government major or even if you've just taken this course, you know, you should be able to kind of talk about it at a level that's a little beyond kind of someone who's just an informed news reader. Right? That's what we're really hoping for in this class. Okay, now, towards that end, got a couple topics we wanted to cover today. Professor McDaniel, from his undisclosed location, wants to talk a little bit about Texas politics and the opioid crisis. So, as you all know, the Texas legislature just concluded its session. They meet in odd years, not odd as an adjective, but odd numbered years. They just closed the session, got a lot of business conducted. Professor McDaniel, you want to talk about some of the bills that that were considered and maybe that I guess that were signed and or vetoed by Governor Abbott?
Yes. So Governor Abbott has until really Father's Day to veto these bills. If he doesn't veto them, they go into effect on September 1st. So this is really the waiting period to see which bills he signs and which bills he vetoes. So far, I've only been able to find one bill that he's vetoed, but today he will be signing a bill at Palmer Lane Elementary regarding school funding. So again, trying to increase school funding. Another thing that's important to note, for all of you who are worried about this, he has legalized lemonade stands for children. There was an attempt on the part of Homeowners Association to try to ban them. No, he's legalized lemonade stands for children selling non-alcoholic beverages. So again, the kids out there selling vodka mixers, things like that, not legal, but lemonade stands, they are. A lot of things dealing with schools, but he's also done raised the age for smoking to 21. So it was 18, now it's now 21, except for military personnel. So military personnel who are 18, who are under 21, or over 18 and under 21, in that period, they can purchase cigarettes. Phasing out red light cameras, also a lot of work to regarding human trafficking, trying to get rid of the backlog of rape kits, but also trying to expand things for sexual assault victims, but then also phasing out red light cameras. So these are things that have been put in, that have been signed. Some, again, if they're not signed by or vetoed by Father's Day, they go into effect on September 1st. Now, one bill has been vetoed, and this is a bill related to domestic violence, that the bill would have required that individuals or survivors of domestic violence would know when their attacker was put on parole or probation or on bond, so they would know. In the process of doing this, the process of getting this through, which was a very popular bill, one of the members of the House added an amendment which lowered basically fees regarding radioactive waste. And so basically the state cannot add radioactive, cannot increase the fees for radioactive waste in this regard. It didn't really go over well with the governor, and so because of that, the bill was vetoed. The bill was vetoed specifically because of this amendment that was added to it. This is not uncommon to see amendments being added to things, especially if it's really popular, that if you want to get something through, you just add something in there that you know will benefit your group, with the hope being that, okay, well, this is something we don't like, but we won't kill it over this. Also, you'll see things added. So a few years back, the National Parks System banned basically quit selling bottled water because there was just waste everywhere. And so they banned that, but in a refunding bill, lobbyists on the part of the water companies were able to kind of put something in which restricted them from banning the sale of bottled water. And so there are classic examples of people kind of putting amendments or adding something onto a bill, especially a bill they think is popular, that what they have is unpopular, but the overall bill is popular, with the hope being the popularity of the bill will cover up what they're trying to do. So it's very interesting to look at these bills, kind of look at these little things that are added on, which may be tangentially related or not related at all, which can sometimes kill a bill from advancing.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. I came to Texas in 1994 from the state of California. California has what we call a professional legislature. And that is a legislature that is in session year-round, every year, where the legislators are paid a professional salary. That is, they don't go back home and have another job. I mean, they might, but they are first and foremost employed as legislators of the state of California. And I came to Texas, and Texas has what we call an unprofessional, or that's not true, a non-professional. Unprofessional is probably a pejorative term. A non-professional legislature, they only meet once every 2 years. The governor can extend the session by calling for a special session, but that hasn't happened this time around. So, you know, as Professor McDaniel suggested, they pretty much wrapped up business. They passed some budgets. It's always interesting to see what the Texas legislature tackles every 2 years. Last cycle they handled or considered at least bathroom bills. A couple sessions before that, they did voter ID. In the bathroom bill session, they also handled a very restrictive abortion, a change in the abortion law, or the funds that are provided to abortion clinics operating in the state of Texas. So, you know, it's interesting. A lot of us may not consider some of these things essential issues confronting the state, especially when the state legislature only meets every 2 years. But they come up for political reasons. Some of them are pet projects for specific legislators. Some of them reflect coalitional interests of the Democratic or Republican parties. And so it's kind of fascinating to see the way the session unfolds. Professor McDaniel mentioned, you know, you have a ton of legislation that comes, you know, through the pipeline in a given session. And a lot of times they don't have a distinct bill associated with a particular ask. They'll put an amendment on another bill that already exists. And so you get these odd combinations, as Professor McDaniel mentioned, you know, just, some sort of odd funding request within the context of a broad budget bill or something like that. So at any rate, hopefully that gives you a little bit of of particular insight that kind of suggests a larger process at work here. Now, another substantive issue, Professor McDaniel, for those of you who don't know, there's a lot on healthcare and healthcare policy, as well as race and ethnicity in the Black church. But we were talking beforehand about drug companies and the opioid crisis. Texas is kind of in the middle of the scale when it comes to all the different states with respect to the opioid crisis. I think that's a fair characterization. The opioid crisis here isn't as acute as it is in a state like New Hampshire or Vermont, perhaps, but I think we feel it a little more than some of the Rocky Mountain states, for instance. So we're kind of in the middle. You hear about the opioid crisis and addiction to painkillers and heroin and heroin substitutes and that thing, not quite as much as you do in the Northeast, but maybe more in the Rocky Mountain states. But you do hear about it here, and the drug companies that have been kind of involved in dealing with the opioid crisis, you know, the interaction between the crisis itself and the drug companies has become an interesting public policy, I guess, area or debate or, you know, kind of case study. And Professor McDaniel, you've been following this fairly closely. I mean, what's your take on the opioid crisis and what's in the news today with respect to the drug companies?
So one thing that's important to note is that much like what we saw with smoking and cigarettes about 20 years ago, where people started going after the cigarette companies for lung cancer and basically faulty advertising, you're seeing this going on with the opioid companies, specifically that there was false advertising. In many cases, they were trying to push doctors to prescribe these medications when they weren't really needed. And one of the things that's in the news now is INSYS, so INSYS, is actually filed for bankruptcy. So they settled with the federal government regarding its illegal marketing of fentanyl. And because they had to pay out, they are now have to file for bankruptcy because that has basically taking out the money that they've been able to earn. You also have Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, recently settled with the state of Oklahoma for $270 million for its activities. And in fact, the family that's behind Purdue Pharma has kind of become persona non grata with a lot of people. They have been known as being great patrons of the arts. Now people don't want to accept anything associated with them because more and more evidence is coming out that they have been heavily pushing these painkillers, and that one of the major problems for the increase of the opioid epidemic is that the pharmaceutical companies kept pushing it, were paying off doctors to prescribe it, in some cases were funneling an illegal market. And so we're seeing, much like we saw 20, 30 years ago in regards to smoking, where people went after the cigarette companies, we're now seeing states and the federal government go after the pharmaceutical companies in regards to the prescription of painkillers. And so the opioid epidemic is really being seen as really caused, not fully caused by them, but that the pharmaceutical companies kept pushing them, specifically arguing that they were non-addictive. And I think that's the same thing you see coming out of the cigarette companies, is they knew it was addictive, they knew it was harmful, but covered up that data. But the pharmaceutical companies, they know this is addictive, but tried to play it off as if it was not addictive and kept pushing it on individuals. So it's going to be important to see how this takes shape, because we're seeing action being taken part at the federal level, at the state level, but also at the local level, where you're seeing a lot of suits coming into play. And it's going to be interesting to see how all this plays out in terms of what is left of the pharmaceutical companies after this, in terms of how they can sell their products, but also how the funds will be used for treatment of the opioid crisis.
Yeah, I've been following this from a public opinion perspective, and it's in public opinion polling, we tend to ask a question, and most of the standard surveys will ask this in state surveys as well as national surveys, you know, what's the most important problem facing the country? And typically you get unemployment, the economy, immigration, border security, terrorism, healthcare. The last two or three years, drugs and the opioid crisis have been mentioned by many people as a critical issue facing their state or facing the nation. And it's something that I think has caught lawmakers, it's caught public policy officials a little bit off guard. It sort of happened and is happening at a level that we did not anticipate. And it's something very, if you ask people, do you know somebody who personally has been addicted to painkillers or had a problem with opioid abuse, about 40 to 50% of people say they know somebody who's had that sort of issue. So it's a very real situation. So we've talked a little bit about Texas and the legislative session, a little bit about the opioid crisis and the drug company connection with the opioid crisis. I want to hit two other topics before we let you all go for the week. One is immigration. And I say immigration, although actually the issue of immigration in the context in which I'm going to talk about it today is the intersection of immigration, border security, economics, tariffs, and really the kind of conflict between state and national governments and between the Congress and the presidency. So let me unpack that real briefly. The most recent sort of issue that we have is President Trump has apparently, the Trump administration has reached a trade agreement with Mexico. Trump had threatened to impose significant tariffs on Mexican imports, which are largely agricultural, not exclusively, but largely agricultural, unless Mexico agreed to step up its efforts to curb the flow of migrants from Mexico or through Mexico to the United States. So, right, so Trump has talked continually, President Trump has talked continually about using tariffs and economic sanctions as a tool for, you know, better relations, better deals with other countries. And on Friday, Trump announced that a deal had been struck. There has been some blowback on from the media and from critics of Trump saying that, well, Mexico actually had already agreed to do many of the things that Trump has heralded. In other words, Trump said, I got a deal, the Mexican government's going to agree to try to, you know, step up their processing of these claims of people going through Mexico to provide help for way stations at the border, et cetera, et cetera. But critics have said, well, they'd already agreed to do that. And Trump has responded by saying, well, no, they hadn't actually. They sort of suggested they would, and now they've agreed to it on an accelerated time frame. So it's a typical, for those of you out there watching politics these days, this is a typical example of it's hard to figure out what's actually going on. One side says this, the other side says that. It's a little difficult to unpack. But I would like to point out a couple things about this particular situation. The first is you're still in what President Trump characterized, in fact, officially declared as an emergency a couple of months ago. And that's critical for the course Professor McDaniel and I are teaching because the president can declare an emergency with respect to a situation, and then that allows him to use powers that he does not ordinarily have. And this goes back to presidential declarations in the late 1960s and early 1970s, which we'll talk about when we get to our presidency lectures. But Trump has invoked a national emergency, and he's argued that he is allowed to do certain things with respect to immigration enforcement that normally would have to go through Congress. But because he's declared an emergency, he's asserted some powers that typically devolve to the legislature, right? Now, the legislature, in this case, the legislature is, of course, Congress. Congress has the right, according to several acts that they passed in the 1970s, to end that emergency period or to force Trump to seek congressional authorization to extend that emergency period, but they have not yet done so. They've denied that he actually has the power to declare an emergency in this situation. So there's a bit of a fight going on between the executive and the legislature over whether Trump's actions on the border are in fact legal and constitutional. Again, Trump has invoked this notion of an emergency and asserted executive powers because there's an emergency. Congress has basically said that there's not an emergency and the president is not authorized to do that. That's something that will be adjudicated by the courts. And by the way, this isn't just a Trump Congress or a president Congress thing in a very contemporary context. We've had Democratic presidents and Republican Congresses who have had this fight in the past, and previous Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses. This is an institutional fight, and one you ought to be aware of in the context of balance, checks and balances, and separation of powers. Then, of course, there's the federalism question, which is states like Texas have an obligation to secure the border in conjunction with federal authorities. So one persistent question is, what rights do the states have here? And what role do the states have to play? If the national government says the states need to do certain things, but they don't provide money, is that what we call an unfunded mandate? Is that something that is legal to require Texas to do something that Texas doesn't necessarily have the funds to do? So this is another interesting question. So once again, as with last week, we had a couple of instances in which there were conflicts at the federal level between and amongst the branches. Then you've got, I'd consider a sort of horizontal conflict, right? Congress, president, courts. There's also vertical conflict, you know, the federal government vis-a-vis the states, and that's not even considering sanctuary cities. So you've got federal, state, and local governments. Sanctuary cities, as you probably know, these are cities that have basically said they're not going to abide by federal mandates or requirements when it comes to turning over information with respect to undocumented people that they have detained for violations of city ordinances or things like that, right? So the city of Austin, for those of you who are interested, has declared itself a sanctuary city. So they are not necessarily going to cooperate with Immigrations and Customs. And that is the legality of that, the sort of propriety of that is something that we really haven't dealt with much as a country. But again, it's an example of the sort of layered cake or marble cake of power that exists in the United States. So I didn't have anything really to say about the immigration tariff thing beyond that. I just want to point it out as another example of these interesting conflicts. Professor McDaniel, you got any particular insight on immigration or...
No, I mean, it's an interesting point that the President Trump has put forward that, look, we put forth these tariffs to get Mexico to step up, but the people said, well, Mexico already agreed to it. It's one of the things that will that need to be resolved in regards to how we handle immigration. It's been a fight that's been going on, or an issue that's been going on for, I guess, really close to two decades now, and really no clear resolution. And as we see things... get worse in Latin America with certain nations, we should expect immigration to increase. In addition, as we have kind of unclear immigration laws or immigration laws that are kind of that are out of date, we should expect to see more problems. And so I think this is going to continue to go on until Congress and the president can actually kind of make a clear decision about how to handle this. Then I think we may be able to have some level of stability within this conversation. But again, this is going up. This has been going on for, I guess, close to two decades now. It started during the Bush administration. Continued during the Obama administration. Has been a key part of the Trump administration.
All right. So let's hit our fourth and final topic. This one's more of a funsy, and it's something of a preview. Professor McDaniel and I have restrained ourselves from talking about the presidential election process. At least I've restrained myself from talking much about it. But we're not going to talk about who's up and who's down so much as just to kind of as a public service notification, just let you all know that over the course of the summer, there are going to be a series, at least two, probably more, of Democratic presidential candidate debates. The first one is coming up at the end of June. I can't remember whether it's the 29th or 30th, but it's at the end of June. It's going to be in Miami. And for those of you who are interested, and even those of you who are not, there are 24, I believe, 23 or 24 current declared candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. So one thing that Professor McDaniel, I wanted to point out to you all, first of all, is that the debate process becomes very important. It used to be that political parties screened candidates, right? That is, you had to go through the elite leadership in order to become a viable candidate for president, right? You had to have the backing of the state parties, and then you went to the national convention, and there was a big fight there, and you lined people up, cut deals, et cetera. Well, that process really effectively ended in the 1950s or so, and now it's sort of a free-for-all. Anybody who wants to be a candidate can be a candidate. And the only thing you need to do is mobilize voters in primaries and caucuses in order to make a viable run for the nomination. So one of the important processes with, I guess, a sub-process within that broader process are debates. These are opportunities for candidates to get well-known, to distinguish themselves, to introduce themselves to the electorate, especially the Democratic electorate. So two major debates coming up, the first, as I said, in Miami at the end of June, the second in July in Detroit. And I would just point out, these are going to be, you know, bring your popcorn for these. Right? They're going to be two nights of debates, and they're going to, my understanding, CNN is going to randomly assign the 24 candidates to debate one, night one, and night two. So it's not going to be based on how you're doing in the polls or how much money you've raised. It's just going to be like a lottery. So you could have Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris and Joe Biden in one, and Beto O'Rourke and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on night two. We don't know who's in night one, who's in night two. They claim it's going to be randomly assigned. Now, I'm a conspiracy theorist, and so I'm looking for like the rigged NBA lottery where the Knicks or the Lakers always seem to get the number one pick. I'm not quite sure how you would rig it, but I'm looking for some sort of intrigue on that front. I think they're going to run an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours. I haven't checked the time specs for CNN. But it'll be very interesting because even with 12 candidates on each night, there's going to be a real fight to get time and attention and to break through the clutter. I realize that we're still a year and a half out from the 2020 election, but it looks like President Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, barring some sort of very, you know, bizarre occurrence. The Democrats have yet to sort things out, and the debate process is going to be an important element of that. All right, so I just wanted to clue you all in on that. I think we might be having some technical difficulties with Professor McDaniel. We don't really care too much about what he thinks about Democratic primary politics anyway. So with that, I think we're done for week two of In the News. Remember to pick one of the topics we've talked about, whether it's the Texas legislative session and the vetoes of and non-vetoes by Governor Abbott, the drug companies and opioid crisis, immigration, the tariff deal with Mexico, and then the upcoming Democratic debates, and just, you know, kind of let us know what you're thinking, connect it to some of the broader concepts that we've talked about in lecture. Again, we got a midterm coming up next week. Look for announcements and emails and follow your syllabus. And with that, this is Professor Shaw for Professor McDaniel. We're signing off for week two.